Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
I am rolling in all the places.
God, listen to this. Audio rolling. Check. Video. Check. All right. Oh, there it is. There it is. Sometimes it just surprises me. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Check. See what I did there?
Please.
Music
check,
playing.
Check,
people
please.
Here.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Hosts here.
Yeah, yeah.
Check.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, our podcast about tech, the economy, and culture. None of us, as we like to say, is as smart as all of us. I will say, by the way, today, just so everybody knows, this is a triple header. It's a three-location enterprise, London and New York City and Oakland, California. So we're all over the place. I'm just, so everybody knows that's what's going on.
Just bear with us. Hope springs eternal. Yes. All of those things. And also, technology is magic. I think this is a good reminder. Today's topic is none of those things, however, except that London was a clue. Because no matter how many articles you read, no matter how many days go by with some new piece of news that confuses you even more, it's still really hard to sound smart about Brexit.
God, it's unbelievable. So back in March, when Brexit was imminent and the prime minister was in some trouble, we did a Brexit episode. And now Brexit is imminent again. And the prime minister's in some trouble, so we're going to try to do another Brexit episode. And here is just a brief shining example of how Boris Johnson, the prime minister of the United Kingdom, is in some trouble. He was asked, I guess this is probably like 3 weeks ago now, maybe longer, perhaps, by a reporter, if he could promise the British public he would not ask for another delay, another extension of Brexit, Britain leaving the European Union. Here is his answer.
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
So Boris Johnson is not dead. He is not in a ditch. Brexit is still imminent, and thus we are here.
Yes, thus we are here. And I like that the last time we talked about it, the prime minister was in trouble. Totally different prime minister, by the way.
Yes.
So yes, Brexit part two, the Brexiting, the sequel. I think a gerund is appropriate here because it is an ongoing Brexit, the Brexiting. So we brought on the great news about getting to cover this on an ongoing basis is that we get to bring back our new favorite correspondent on this and other topics, Roz Atkins, who hosts the BBC news show called Outside Source.
Hi, you two. Nice to be back. How's things?
Yes, thanks for coming back.
They are good. My goodness.
Did you know something I didn't know when you asked me to come in today? Today of all days? Because
I mean, magical.
Right. I was thinking as I was just walking towards the studio, you know, you had hundreds of days you could have picked across the last few years, and really you could make an argument, a decent argument, that today the relationship between the UK and its European partners is more fragile, is more uncertain than it's been since the end of the Second World War. And if that seems hyperbolic, it's really not. The last 24 hours have cranked it up to notches that we didn't even really know existed. It's a bit like, you know, in Spinal Tap where they say turn it up to 11. We're kind of at that stage now.
Yeah. All right.
Well, tell us why. What happened?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the two things have happened. The context to all of this is that we are charging towards October the 31st. This is the Brexit deadline. This is when Brexit is scheduled to happen. And unless the UK requests an extension, and it hasn't, unless the EU says yes to that request, that is when Brexit's going to happen. Before that, you've got a European Union summit, which takes place next week, Thursday, Friday, October the 17th and 18th. It's widely accepted that if there is no agreement between the UK and the EU on how the UK is going to leave, well, that's really the last chance saloon. The reason things have cranked up in the last 24 hours is that last night, the political editor of The Spectator magazine, a political magazine, published a lengthy message from inside Number 10 detailing their view of the situation, and it is like no other political memo we've seen. It says negotiations will probably end this week, that preferential treatment in the future will go to European countries who are deemed to be helpful at the moment. It's saying if the deal collapses this week, that's it. It talks about plans to scupper any effort to stop a no-deal Brexit at the end of the month. And perhaps most astonishing of all, it says any countries supporting a delay in Brexit, and by that they mean some of the other EU members, they'll be seen as hostile interference in UK politics. So this is incendiary. So we all digest that overnight and we're thinking, my goodness. And then as the morning unfolds, we're told that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has spoken to Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, and then number 10 briefs that this has gone absolutely terribly, that essentially it's now impossible to get a deal. So that in itself is huge news. But then the whole European press corps, or a lot of it, starts going, that doesn't sound like the kind of thing that Angela Merkel would say. And so we now have this huge fight going on between lots of people saying that doesn't sound right, and number 10 saying this is how this phone call went. But whether one side is right or the other is right, the fact of the matter is it's being seen as a briefing war by number 10 on the most important country in the European Union. And as such, things are beginning to crumble in a way that we've not seen in the last 3 years of the Brexit process.
So we are no strangers to differing interpretations of phone call readouts between leaders of countries over here. So there's that. But look, isn't there a law on the books that says there will not be a no-deal Brexit? Didn't Parliament pass that like 2 weeks ago or whatever it was?
It did. And let me give you another vignette from today, because just the last 24 hours gives me enough to make a number of podcasts with you, frankly. Michael Gove, one of the most senior figures in the Leave campaign in 2016, now a cabinet minister with responsibility for preparing for a no-deal Brexit. A no-deal Brexit meaning the UK leaves with absolutely no arrangements in place with the European Union as to what happens next. Michael Gove, just a few hours ago, standing up in the House of Commons, briefing Parliament, briefing members of Parliament on the government's preparations for a no-deal Brexit, when he and everyone else who's sitting on those famous green leather benches knows that a few weeks ago, Parliament passed a law saying you can't do a no-deal Brexit. The law says if you reach October the 19th, the day after that EU summit, and you don't have a deal, the Prime Minister must send a letter asking for an extension. So you have a law in place which says that's got to happen. You have a Prime Minister who says, I won't be requesting that request, that extension. You have a cabinet minister briefing Parliament on something which the law says cannot happen. And you have a senior number 10 source sending out an extended briefing last night saying, we've got lots of plans to get around this law. And as such, everyone is thinking, my goodness, no deal between the UK and the EU looks pretty likely, bearing in mind how things are going this week. So what on earth happens when we reach October the 19th? And no one has any idea.
I feel slightly, I feel slightly speechless, I confess. Where do we even start here? Like, how unprecedented is it at this point for the Prime Minister and his administration to essentially be saying, we intend to ignore this law, or as The Guardian put it, sidestep or frustrate this law?
Well, you know, the Prime Minister is saying two things which look difficult to square. He's saying, I will not request an extension, though it's widely accepted that in the end, an extension is reasonably likely, although I'm a hostage to fortune saying that. But at the moment, an extension looks likely. You have a Prime Minister saying, look, I won't request it. And you have a law which says you have to request it if you get to October the 19th. Now, that the fact that we don't have any clarity on that is certainly extraordinary. But let's just step back a bit here, Kai and Molly, and remember the context. This is a Prime Minister who's already been found to have unlawfully suspended Parliament by the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, and who was also found by the Court of Sessions in Edinburgh, a court a rung down from the Supreme Court, to have essentially lied to the Queen about the reasons that he suspended Parliament. So we're already into uncharted territory. We've been in uncharted territory for some time. The point here is that the Prime Minister and his allies say, of course, they respect the rule of law, but they reiterate they will not ask for an extension. And until they allow that to play out, we can't really know what they're planning to do. And this now infamous memo, which is dominating the news, or it certainly was until about five other things happened, says quite explicitly, we've got plans to not follow this law, but at the same time, of course, we're not going to tell you those because that might affect our ability to carry out these plans legally. So we're all in the dark, really.
The news cycle speed over there does seem a little Trumpian, right? I mean, things happen over here with astonishing speed, and now it sort of seems like it's happening over there at the same pace. Let me ask you a question, though, Roz, and it goes like this. If I am a business person in the United Kingdom facing the prospect of literally not knowing what's going to happen, or if I'm a consumer, right, why am I not stockpiling goods, taking all my money out of the bank, shoving it under my mattress, and bracing for Armageddon?
Well, some people are. Not the majority of people, but some people are doing some stockpiling. I think the reason that more people aren't stockpiling is because there's still a belief that in the end, no deal's not going to happen. And that belief is rooted in two things. One, the fact everyone knows if the UK requests an extension, the EU is very, very likely to accept it. So there's always that route. And bear in mind, Parliament has voted on a law which the majority of MPs thinks locks in the fact that no deal Brexit cannot happen. So for those two reasons, the law that was recently passed and the EU's position, I think a lot of people think, well, between those two things, a no deal Brexit is not particularly likely. However, in the background, you do have a situation with the Prime Minister saying, I consider this a viable option. What happened with Theresa May was she started off saying no deal is better than a bad deal, but by the end of the negotiations was essentially ruling out a no deal Brexit. And that's a big difference between Theresa May and Boris Johnson. In the end, she turned away from that option. At the moment, he's definitely not turning away from that option. But I would add more broadly, when it comes to businesses, everyone wants certainty. Whichever side of the Brexit argument they're on, the overwhelming sentiment from businesses who speak to the BBC is, my goodness, please just tell us what's going on. The bad news for them is they may not get the answers they're hoping for in terms of certainty anytime soon. That's cheered you up, hasn't it?
Yeah, right?
I mean, Kai, yeah, thanks. Good job, guys. Good job, producers. And then to just go even darker for a minute. I mean, Kai brought up the parallel to what's happening in the United States government, which is a sort of a similar saying, let's say pushing the boundaries of the rule of law, or, you know, which laws actually apply, whether it's subpoenas or in this case, a law that says you cannot crash out of the UK. What are the chances that we find ourselves having a relatively normal version of this conversation again? Like you're saying that on some level, everybody is sort of counting on existing structures to prevail. How high would you say the confidence is that they will?
Well, I think already some of the existing structures which have governed certainly life in the West are beginning to shift. I was at the G7 summit in Biarritz and I was watching the press conference between Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump at the end. And your president was saying there's been great unity at this summit. And with all respect to your president, there really wasn't great unity at that summit on the big issues, whether it was climate change or regulation of world trade or Iran. There was no unity between America and its European counterparts. Now we're seeing schisms between the UK and its European allies as well. And as such, that coherence that the West once had as it approached the biggest issues in the world, that is already under severe stress. And whatever the Brexit outcome, that's not really going anywhere. The other thing is that the whole Brexit process, and to some degree Mr. Trump's success as well, is driven by a few core ideas. One being that the immigration that comes with globalization is not desirable, that it should be restricted, that sovereignty of individual nation states is vital. And as such, that's a rejection of supranational bodies, whether that might be the UN or the EU in their current forms. And then you've also got the idea of democracy, which is huge here in the Brexit issue, because those people who voted for Brexit in 2016 quite rightly point out, look, 52% of us voted for this. It was over 3 years ago. Yeah. Why is it not happening? And as such, if Brexit weren't to happen, its supporters say this would be a fundamental crisis in the way that democracies work. There's a counter-argument to that, which is that we have a parliamentary democracy. Referendums are a direct form of democracy, and those two types of democracy are not necessarily particularly complementary in all circumstances. But I would say that the fundamentals which tied the West together, the core ideas which they shared, these countries, since the mid-1940s, they're just not shared in the same way anymore. And that's not going to be put together tomorrow or at the end of the month, whether Brexit happens or doesn't happen, whether Donald Trump wins or doesn't win next year. These are more fundamental shifts about how people see their country and how their countries fit into the world. And it's no longer as simple as saying the UK and America and other European countries who are part of the EU all have a relatively similar view of the world. It's just not true anymore.
You know, it's funny because you said something very similar when we spoke with you back in March. And I guess I'm struck by the fact that we continue to careen toward the edge. And even if there is not a similar view of how countries interact and have a place in the world, the distressing fact is we keep tiptoeing up to the edge of disaster but without a sense of what comes after the disaster.
But I suppose I would say back to that, Kai, it depends who you ask. Not everyone would see this as a disaster. Lots of people have profound concerns about the nature of globalization. Lots of people have profound concerns about the nature of capitalism. We had the FT, for goodness sake, running a big feature very recently about how capitalism needs to be reinvented. We've had, I think, the Prime Minister of New Zealand making comments about there being fundamental problems with how capitalism is currently working and how capitalism is currently addressing concerns around inequality. So to ask for a change, well, lots of people would say, look, this system does need to change. Where there is disagreement, of course, is what that change should be. And what's also interesting is that as this change comes thick and fast, in this case in the form of Brexit, it's asking really fundamental questions about how countries interact. So let's really laser in as an example on why these Brexit talks are struggling. It's all to do with the Irish border. It's all to do with the fact that if the UK government listens to concerns about immigration, listens to concerns about sovereignty, listens to concerns about lawmaking being rooted in a national parliament, and leaves the EU single market and leaves the EU's customs union to deliver those things for people who wanted Brexit. How do you do that without having some form of border between Northern Ireland, which is in the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, a nation state within the EU? How do you do that? And fundamentally, that was the problem which everyone was discussing when I went to an emergency EU summit in the summer of 2016, a few days after the Brexit vote, and it is still the conundrum. You have to create a border that is like no other. Now, the UK government and Boris Johnson say its proposals do that. The EU says it's not convinced. But really at the heart of that issue, as well as peace on the island of Ireland, is actually the issue of how do nation states interact and trade? How do we regulate the way that goods and people flow between countries and flow between entities like the EU and people outside entities like the EU? And these are really fundamental issues about how we organize our world. And people who are pushing for change with Brexit would say, we want to have conversations about that. We want to get into this nitty gritty because the current manifestation of the way our world is working is not right for us. And so for all of those reasons, while some people would say we're driving towards a cliff edge, other people would say, look, it is going to be scary. There may be an economic hit. There may be political turbulence. There may be consequences, negative consequences of doing this. But overall, it's worth it for the broader goals that we're pursuing. With Brexit, I don't think this is just about Boris Johnson or about Donald Tusk or Jean-Claude Juncker. These are about fundamentally different views of how people would like their country to be. And while the characters may change and the story may twist and turn, I don't necessarily think those different perspectives are going to go anywhere in the near future. And if I left you with one thought, it would be that when Brexit was voted on in 2016, we essentially faced four options, that the decision was reversed, that there was a no-deal Brexit because no deal could be found, that there was a soft Brexit, which essentially meant remaining aligned to the EU in lots of ways, but being outside of it to some degree, and a hard Brexit, which meant leaving the single market and leaving the customs union. Well, a soft Brexit's gone. Brexiteers say that doesn't really count as Brexit, so we don't want it. So that has really gone. So we've gone from four options down to three. At the moment, the possibility of a deal is looking incredibly low. That might change by the time people hear this podcast, but it's looking incredibly low. And so suddenly the two options which at the beginning looked like the most extreme, reversing the decision or just leaving without any arrangements in place, suddenly seem like the two most likely outcomes, potentially. And if they do become the two most likely outcomes, what that tells us is really, really important, and it's relevant to the UK and to America. And it's that fundamentally, these different views of the world are really hard to reconcile, and people aren't necessarily in the mood to compromise. And it's for that reason that I would argue that however the next few weeks shakes down, and goodness knows I'm not going to predict that, that the issues that we're seeing playing out and the schisms we're seeing playing out, both in the UK and America, are probably going to outlast any of the political players who are currently right in the middle of them.
Roz Atkins, host of Outside Source at BBC News, our favorite.
Did that help?
It helped as much as it could. You've made it as clear as mud.
That's great.
Roz, you're fantastic. Thank you.
All right. See you soon. Bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye now. God. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But, yep. but you know what's really interesting? I mean, you know, the parallels between what's going on there and what's going on here are so profound. And I think they are rooted in that thing he was talking about different visions of how people see their country interacting with the rest of the world. That's
without a doubt. I mean, I think I've said on this show and others that in some ways the election of Donald Trump, the vote for Brexit, they are forms of revolution. They are people rebelling against the status quo. And that rebellion, like you said, isn't going to go away. Roz is so good also. He's just so good. Yeah. Tell us what you think, whether it is of the issues in the UK or here and how they interact. Do we have any British listeners? If so, send us a voice memo. And the rest of you can join too. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. I want to know that we brought up this idea of whether women are listening and sending us voice memos.
Oh, yeah.
And there's now a hashtag that has appeared on at least my Instagram. Yeah,
oh, wow.
That said, I think girls listen too. #girls listen too.
That's awesome.
And this woman said she's going to send us a voice memo. So we'll be looking.
All right.
Email us.
Cool. Rawhide. Oh, sorry. That would have been pretty funny. All right, we're back. Mollywood in the nick of time has gotten her story into our news fix portion of this podcast. So, Ms. Wood, since it's fresh, go ahead.
This is how I always did my homework, too. Like, what? It's there. Just because it wasn't there 30 seconds ago doesn't mean it's not there.
If it wasn't early enough, it wouldn't be the deadline.
Exactly. I have one obsession this week, and that obsession is the NBA and its relationship with China. Have you followed any of this story?
I'm following all of it, but for those who aren't,
for those who are not, okay. So here's what happened: the general manager of the Houston Rockets, in a few days ago, tweeted in support of pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, and this was a problem for both Daryl Morey, who tweeted about it, the general manager, for the NBA, for the Houston Rockets, and now potentially for the reputation of the NBA in the United States. And it is a fascinating look at how, in some ways, sort of despite all that's happening with the trade war, like China still owns our economy in some really significant ways. Like the NBA,
well,
in fact, I've been talking for a long time.
That's a little much.
Okay. Maybe not owns our economy.
Well, there you go.
How profoundly important China as a customer base is to industries that represent huge portions of our economy, like entertainment, like sports, like electronics. I mean, it's, you know, so yes, I'll break it down and be more specific at the risk of being hyperbolic, but it's a big deal. And it's also interesting to see how companies get to the point where they essentially have to sort of check their social morals at the border of the Chinese market. So the NBA has been extremely progressive in the United States in terms of its views, and it's, you know, it pulled the All-Star game out of North Carolina to protest the bathroom bill there and the discrimination against transgender people in North Carolina. And yet the NBA has unequivocally shut down any suggestion that it would be okay for anyone within its organization to show support for the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, and has completely backed China and said, it's our friends and fans in China. This market's so important to us. Our loyalties stand with what many U.S. consumers are saying is, hey, a pretty autocratic regime that may or may not be, or that is imprisoning Uyghurs and, disappearing people and is not the kind of government that the NBA or other organizations would purport to support. So it's a fine, now they're having to walk this fine line between what the customers in the United States want and what the Chinese market wants. And I'm just saying that the swiftness with which the NBA was like, nope, we choose China, tells you a lot about the economic importance.
So yes to most of that. I do want to give Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, a little bit of due here, because this morning, and maybe you haven't seen this because it's way early on the East Coast, on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Adam Silver came out this morning and said he's not going to censor players or team owners over China or other issues. And here's what he says. The league is motivated by much more than money, and freedom of expression must be protected. So just for the record, Silver is saying the right things. What the league does mm-hmm. is an entirely different issue. And it's absolutely true that when Daryl Morey's tweet hit the Twitter sphere, as it were, the feces hit the oscillating rotary device in a very big way.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a huge problem for the NBA. But at least here now on day three on this thing? Day four? Mm-hmm. Silver is starting to, make the right noises, I guess.
Well, sure, because U.S. consumers are making the right noises.
Yeah.
Right, this is exactly the tension. And long term, what Adam Silver ends up doing, and the NBA, and look, yes, I will recognize that the NBA in some ways is in a no-win situation. Yeah. But oh God, I can't believe I'm going to sound this cynical. But when you Kai say businesses are only being socially progressive or saying that they're not going to sell guns, or saying that shareholder value shouldn't be the driving force, that all of that is mm-hmm. like a cynical ploy for woke millennial customers, then this is where the feces hits the fan in terms of the NBA attempting to cater to both.
Yeah.
Old story.
Yeah. I mean, yes. The old story with constantly evolving and refreshing examples. I just think this is a really interesting time for the NBA, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
I agree.
That's what I got.
I agree.
All right. So mine kind of plays out of what Roz was saying, and it comes in the person of Kristalina Georgieva. She is the managing director of the International Monetary Fund. They're gearing up for their fall meetings, and she's doing a round of media appearances. And I would just highlight something she said, which is that the woman running the International Monetary Fund, and her chief economist, also a woman, by the way, for the record, see serious risk of a global slowdown. And they see risk that slowdown will spread, which is, of course, making people everywhere nervous because the IMF kind of has its pulse on that stuff. And I mention it in this context. What Roz was talking about countries seeing people in countries seeing themselves interacting with the rest of the global economy in a different way, that comes with economic cost. Because while there have certainly been losers with free trade, on the whole, free trade has raised many, many, many people and many countries to a level of a quality of life and living that was not possible before. And I think part of the challenge now, as Britain pulls away from the European Union and the United States pulls out of every free trade agreement that the president can find and engages in tariff wars, there is an economic cost to this political upheaval that is happening. And I just wanted to point that out. That's what I got.
Yeah. I really think we should do our show about growth. I had someone ask me the other day, what is the big deal if we just don't grow all the time? I mean, I think, people really have that question. Like, if the driving force has been growth and there's this sense that the boats have been lifted generally, but not lifted that high, I mean, you have only to drive through some of the most devastated rural parts of America to understand why that anger is still there.
Sure.
And why it's sort of like, you can say the boat was lifted, but it basically, the boat lifted just out of the water, but we still have to bail. I don't know.
Well, it's so interesting, right? This is why Jay Powell talks all the time, chairman of the Fed, talks all the time about the importance of keeping this expansion going, because he says, and reporting bears this out, mm-hmm. that what's happening now for the first time in a, 11-year-long expansion, this expansion has been really good for the people at the top. It's been pretty good for the people in the middle. Just now, at the 11th year are people at the lower end of the income spectrum seeing benefits of rising wages and increased job possibilities and all of those things. And that's why Jay Powell is concentrating on this so much. Mm. And as the global economy slows because of trade wars and Brexit and tariffs and fatigue and take your pick, those people who are just now seeing the benefits are going to be among the first to suffer.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good right, answer. Yeah. Good answer.
There we go. Speaking of answers, we're going to have some. Are we doing this next week? Are we doing the Explain-a-thon next week? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess so. According to the rundown, we are.
I am told in my headphones that we are doing it next week. So we need your Explain-a-thon questions. Email them to us. Voice memos are best. Make me smart at marketplace.org.
We better start studying.
No studying, no studying, no studying. You're not allowed to study. You got to go in cold.
You can study. You just still have to perform
you may not.
In the moment.
This is a test of lived experience.
In which our lived experience is obsessively read the news all day, every day. That's all. It's studying. I'm just saying, on the Great British Baking Show, they know that they're going to make a, you know, Queen Amon or whatever, and then doesn't mean it's not difficult. Okay, I'm off the rails. Shall we let some other people talk for a moment?
Yes. Yes.
Your turn.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so if all y'all have been keeping up with this podcast, you know we've been talking about climate change lately. But there are some out there of who this next one is an example who thinks we ought to be doing more about it, not just on this podcast, but in public radio more broadly. This one is from Francesca Perez. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Thank you, Molly, for your recent piece on climate change and tech. I am a marine biologist in the Pacific Northwest. For the last 6 months or so, it has been driving me crazy when I hear Kai or other NPR or APM reporters discussing the oil market or the oil industry without there ever being a mention of climate carbon in the same piece of journalism. Would it hurt to objectively add a factoid or two with every one of these types of pieces? Something along the line of, X billions of barrels of oil is equivalent to X potential tons of atmospheric carbon, which is projected to warm our planet by X degrees by 20XX. Just saying.
So, two thoughts, one of which is, yes, I grant the point in the abstract, but then I did a little research and I found this website from the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which does these breakdowns. It gives you the equivalents. And here is its breakdown for carbon emissions per mile driven. And they go through a whole bunch of math and then they come out with, so, per mile driven, you get 4.09 times 10 to the negative fourth metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And I would just submit that if I say that on the radio, my mom, who listens every single day, and I'm a 50-something-year-old man, right? My mom will turn off the radio. That's where
okay.
I am.
Okay. I will grant you
so
not
context
good radio
is important,
argument.
But yeah. Yeah.
I do. I
look,
do
context
think
is
though,
important. I grant you that. Yeah,
context is important, and I do actually think that there are areas where we all can do better at this, and it's, for example, when we talk about, because I increasingly you'll hear consumers say, "Oh, this thing was delivered to me, but the downstream economic downstream environmental cost of that is huge." For example, so I think that there are times when we report on, I don't know, a huge trucking deal or a huge change in the delivery economy or something where there are opportunities for us to insert those questions. And it has not been a thinking muscle, right? So that, yes, we might report on that deal. And then there is an opportunity to say, yeah, and by the way, there's a sustainability impact to that. And it just becomes like a way of thinking about, frankly, all the stories we do that hopefully we're just getting better at because it's, you know, so much more top of mind. Last week, during our fixations, I was talking about the possibility of different states having different rules governing online privacy and our use of the internet and whether that would present certain problems or complaints for internet providers. Not only Kai Rizdahl, but also Dan Zuglul from Tampa were not buying that. Just not buying it.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Dan from Tampa. I was listening to your Marketplace post about the whole advertising being in different places. And I just don't believe the nonsense. They just don't want to do it. if these companies can mystically know exactly where I am at any moment in time, regardless of whether or not I give them GPS permissions, or even if I have a VPN, they still seem to mystically know exactly where I am. They cannot turn around and then say the argument, oh, I'm sorry, we can't know where you are when it's inconvenient to us. But when it is convenient, they seem to have all the power in the world. So, yeah, I don't think it's real.
So, yeah.
Look,
amen, my brother.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Where are we here? Let's see. We are going to the Make Me Smart question. This one comes from Kim Ibarra. She's in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, Kai and Molly. First of all, thanks to Molly for entreating listeners to call in. I actually thought there were so many listeners sending you messages that mine would never get through. I guess I was wrong about that, but that's actually not my story. When I began teaching high school French and Spanish over 20 years ago, I thought the most important part of what I did in the classroom was to do a good job teaching my content, to make sure students learned the language, and to encourage them to continue on in college and then maybe even using it in their careers. But now I realize that actually the most important thing that I do has nothing to do with my content area. My most important job is to make real connections with my students, to ask how their game went or what they did on the weekend, to show that I understand the pressure that they are under to be the best, and how much anxiety that can cause. So even though I still try to be the best teacher I can be, I now believe that the human connection is what is most important. And sometimes that can make all the difference in a student's life.
Yeah. Amen, right? I mean, It is brutal being a kid today. Brutal.
It is. And I know it's also brutal being a teacher. And so it's pretty wonderful to have any teachers step back and have that realization, which is like, look, maybe you don't have to get them to memorize every single date about the Civil War, but you could still care about them.
It occurs to me, I forgot to actually say what the Make Me Smart question is, but all y'all know it, right? What is something you thought you knew, but then found out you were wrong about? Just, you know, as a back announce here on that.
Did you send us your
answers too, please.
Did you read that off your microphone arm where you have it taped just in case you forget?
No, I don't have it in here. I'm in New York and I'm a little adrift.
Oh, that's right. Well done. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah. Explain-a-thon questions, please, people. Send us your voice memos, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, subscribe to the newsletter. It's awesome. We put a link to last week's issue in the show notes, but you can subscribe at marketplace.org/newsletters so you don't miss one. And there it is. The music.
Make Me Smart was produced and directed this week by the new guy, Sam Anderson. He's doing a great job yet again with production help from Tony Wagner. Our senior producer this week was Bridget Bodner, who is also doing a great job. Thanks to all of you and to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore.
This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday, also by Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Sitar said she didn't even quit after last week's show.
I know.
So do you currently have no people looking at you through the glass? Like nobody in the control room? Are you freaking out?
There is one person here with me in the studio, sitting there very quietly on her phone.
Aw.
That's it.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
No, not so bad at all. Not so bad at all.
So, dang it. Just give me like 1 second.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm on it with the news fix. Just don't panic. I haven't. I mean, I have one. I just haven't put it in. I'm on it.
The dog ate my homework.
The dog ate my... Look, man. I told you it was picture day.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.